It was that in-between time of day, after daylight but before nightfall, and Falcon was some 20 miles from Medora. Although he wasn't acting in any official capacity, he was still on the trail of Aaron Childers, Dalton Yerby, and Percy Shaw. About an hour earlier, he had lost their trail, but he was sure he would find it again. It was just a matter of patience, and it was Falcon's experience that the hunter always had more experience than the hunted. Falcon liked this twilight time of day best. The sun had set, but it was still light, the soft, silver kind of light that took away the glare and the heat. He had put on a pot of coffee a few minutes ago and was squatting by the fire, watching the glowing coals while waiting for the coffee to boil, when he felt a tingling on the back of his neck. He was being watched. Without being obvious about what he was doing, Falcon surveyed the area around him and discovered that he was being watched by three men. The strange thing was, the three men watching him now were not the three men he had been trailing. He knew this without knowing exactly how he knew it. Men who lived their lives like Falcon McAllister took on senses that were beyond that of a normal person. Falcon prepared himself for the danger that lay ahead. He tossed another stick of wood into the fire and paid a lot of attention to stirring the coals while quietly loosening the leather straps that held down the hammer of his pistol. He waited, keeping a sideways watch and an open ear. He had a feeling they would make their play when he started to pour his cup of coffee, thinking they could catch him while he was distracted. As he took his tin cup from his saddlebag, Falcon was exceptionally keen to everything going on around him. He reached for the coffee pot. Just as he predicted, his adversaries took that precise moment to make their move. Turning toward him, Falcon dropped to the ground, then rolled to the right, even as the three men charging him opened fire. The bullets dug into the ground exactly where Falcon had been but a second earlier. Falcon wound up on his stomach with his pistol in his hand.
Shoot the son of a bitch, Zeb! Shoot him!
Falcon recognized two of the shooters. Muley and Zeb were the men who had accosted Roosevelt in the saloon back in Medora. He didn't know who the third man was, but he didn't have time to speculate. He fired. The stranger and Muley were dead. Zeb had taken two bullets in the gut and lay holding both hands over the wound, trying without success to stem the flow of blood. Falcon remained on his belly, gun in hand, for a moment longer, just to make sure there were no other surprises coming.
Damn, this hurts! This really hurts!
Falcon got up and cautiously walked over to look down at his wounded assailant.
You're Zeb?
Yeah.
Why'd you come after me, Zeb?
You know why!
Surely you ain't talking about the business that happened back in Medora. Not even you could be that dumb, could you? That little altercation didn't seem like enough to get yourself killed over.
We thought you was the one would get killed. Besides, Rafferty paid us $50 apiece to come with him.
Rafferty?
That's him over there with the top of his head blowed off.
Falcon walked over to look down at Rafferty. He had never seen him before in his life.
Why'd he want me dead?
When Zeb didn't answer him, Falcon looked back toward him. Zeb had fallen to one side. His head was back, and his eyes were open but unseeing. He wasn't hurting anymore. Looking around, Falcon found the three horses the men had ridden in on. They were ground hobbled less than 100 yards away. Emptying their saddlebags, he examined the contents until it was too late to see, hoping by his investigation to find out just who Rafferty was and why he wanted him dead. He learned nothing. For a moment, Falcon considered burying the three men out here where he killed them, but finally decided to take them into town. He threw the bodies across the backs of the horses. He hated to subject the horses to the ordeal of carrying the weight of a dead body through the entire night, but he was afraid that rigor mortis would set in and he would be unable to get him on the animals by morning. When Falcon rode into Medora the next morning, he stirred the curiosity of the town. It wasn't every day that someone rode in leading three horses, each with a corpse thrown across the saddle. The first of the curious townspeople picked him out as soon as he came into town, followed him down the street. The numbers grew as he came closer to the sheriff's office. Sheriff John Dennis came out front to meet Falcon. He scratched a match on the pillar supporting the overhang of his porch, then held it to the end of an already half-smoked cigar. Palming the match with his hand to keep it from blowing out, he took several puffs, squinting at Falcon through the smoke. Finally, he nodded toward the men who were belly down on the horses.
"Do you even know who they are?"
Before Falcon could answer, several of the townspeople moved in and began examining the bodies more closely.
"Sheriff, this here one is Zeb Kingsley. That one's Mildred Simpson. Both of them used to ride for Don Montgomery."
"Who's the third? Did he ride for Montgomery as well?"
"I don't know. I ain't never seen him in the saloon or nothing before. Whoever he is, got the top of his head blowed off."
"His name's Rafferty."
Falcon was still in his saddle, though he had crooked one leg across the pommel and was just sitting there, calmly watching the reaction of the town to his arrival with the three dead bodies.
"Rafferty, what's his first name?"
"I don't know his first name. Rafferty's all I know."
"You have any idea what happened to him?"
"Yeah, I do."
"Well?"
"Well, what?"
"What happened to him?"
"Oh, I thought you knew. I killed him."
"Yes, well, I don't know this Rafferty fella, but if there was ever any two sons of bitches that needed killing more than Muley and Zeb, I'd like to know who they are. I say good riddance to the both of them."
"Well, wait a minute. I rode with them two boys. From time to time, they was a little high-spirited, but that don't give anyone the right to shoot them down. Sheriff Dennis, what are you going to do about this?"
The sheriff held up his hand to quiet the crowd, then squinted through his cigar smoke at Falcon.
"Seems to me like I recall you having yourself a run-in with Muley and Zeb a few days ago, over at the saloon. You shot him up a little."
"Yeah, I did."
"So what'd you decide to do, finish the job?"
"I didn't have any choice, Sheriff. They came after me."
"They came after you, did they? All three of them?"
"That's right."
"Mister, you want us to believe you took these men on 3-1 and beat them all?"
"No, I don't care what you believe."
"Sheriff, Mr. Montgomery ain't gonna take too kindly if you just let this fella get away with murdering a couple of his men like that, even if they ain't riding for him no more."
"After that incident in the saloon the other day, I made some inquiries about you, Falcon McAllister. Turns out I have a dodger on you. Did you know you got reward posters out saying you're wanted for murder?"
"I know about them. I also know they've been recalled."
"Uh-huh. Yeah, when I inquired about them, that's what I was told. It's just as well. If you handled all three of these men by yourself, I don't think I'd want to try and serve a warrant on you."
"So what are you saying, Sheriff? That you're just gonna let him get away with murder?"
"Take it easy, Sutton. Everyone who knew Muley and Zeb knows they was just the kind that would try a damn fool stunt like this. Besides which, if McAllister here actually did murder them, he wouldn't have brought their bodies in, and he wouldn't have confessed to killing them now, would he? So I got no reason not to believe his story."
"Thanks.
But what I want to know is, what about this third fella? What kind of beef did he have with you?"
"I don't know.
Could be he was just some friend of Muley and Zeb's that they talked into helping him."
"Could be."
Falcon didn't tell the sheriff that it was just the other way around, that Rafferty had paid Muley and Zeb to help him. For the moment, he decided that information was best kept to himself. Sheriff Dennis stepped down to look at the three bodies, then stopped to look at one of the horses.
"Say, wait a minute. This mare belongs to Chance Ingram, doesn't it?"
"Well, you're right, it does. That's Belle. I've ridden her myself a few times. Chance rents her out."
"What's Zeb doing on a rented horse?"
"Muley's on Zeb's horse, and the fella with his head blowed off is on Muley's horse."
"I found the horse's ground hobbled. I didn't know who belonged to which horse, and under the circumstances, it didn't seem to matter much."
"Well, this here Rafferty fella is obviously the one that rented himself a horse. That can only mean that he come into town some other way, either by train or by stage. Maybe if I ask around, I'll be able to find out who he is. I'm going to ask you again, Falcon. You're sure you don't know anything about him?
I never saw him before.
There was one in the crowd who had more than a passing interest in the fate of the man Falcon had identified as Rafferty. Creed Howard wasn't a citizen of Medora, but had arrived on the same train as the man who had been identified as Rafferty. Creed offered no information, but he could have told him all about Rafferty, including the fact that Rafferty wasn't his real name. His real name was Bob Howard. Bob and Creed Howard were brothers. Only one other person in town knew that fact, and that was Isham Porter. Isham Porter worked at the wagon yard, and he was Creed and Bob's first cousin. It was Isham Porter who sent Creed and Bob a telegram, telling them that Falcon McAllister, the man who was responsible for getting their youngest brother, Thad Howard, hung, was in Medora. Creed and Bob came to town looking for revenge. Bob got impatient, and Bob got killed. But then Bob always was one impatient son of a bitch. When Creed went after McAllister, he would be more careful.
More wine, Teddy?
Yes, thank you.
Judge Heckmeyer nodded at one of his house staff, and the young man hurried to the far end of the long table to pour wine into Roosevelt's glass. The table, which could easily seat 20, had only three around it now. Judge Andrew Heckmeyer, Theodore Roosevelt, and Anna Heckmeyer. Roosevelt was the Heckmeyer's dinner guest.
It was most gracious of you to invite me over for dinner. I have made friends with the staff at my ranch, but it is still a lonely place. Don't get me wrong, I appreciate the solitude, especially now that I have things to deal with.
Anna knew that Roosevelt was referring to the mourning period he was going through, grieving for both his wife and his mother.
But sometimes that solitude can become quite overwhelming.
Realizing that he had changed the mood of the dinner by his melancholy, Roosevelt raised his glass.
Enough of my gloomy talk. I propose a toast to Miss Heckmeyer's graduation from the very fine school she attended.
Hear, hear.
Thank you. And I've told you, Mr. Roosevelt, it is Anna, not Miss Heckmeyer.
Of course it is. And Anna is such a beautiful name. So, I promise you, from now on, Anna it is.
Tell us about your school, Anna. Did you learn anything marvelous?
I got a glimpse into the future.
A glimpse into the future? Heavens, don't tell me you went to a fortune teller.
No, not that kind of future. I didn't have my personal future told. I mean that in our class on modern science and its applications, I got to see what life in America will be like in the next century.
Did you now? So, tell us about 20th century America.
The 20th century will be a century of marvelous inventions and gadgets. Why, we've already started.
How so?
Consider my recent trip here, from New York. I sent you a telegraph message informing you of the precise day and hour I would arrive. And only 8 days after leaving New York, I was here. Consider that only 30 years ago, this same trip would have taken me months to complete.
That's true.
And back in New York, there are already wondrous things that the people out here can only imagine. Well, Teddy, you know what I'm talking about. You can reach any spot in the city within a matter of minutes by taking the cars.
Taking the cars?
That's what the New Yorkers call the commuter trains that whisk them from one end of the city to the other. Sometimes you ride on elevated railways so that, as a passenger, you feel as if you're flying amidst the rooftops.
That is true. The transportation system of the city is quite well developed.
There are also several telephones in New York.
Telephones? Yes, I believe I have read about them. If I understand it right, it is a device that you can speak into and someone else who is similarly equipped will be able to hear you.
Not only hear you, but speak back to you. And let us not forget Mr. Edison's talking machine.
A talking machine? Now I've heard everything.
No, it is true, Andrew. The Edison talking machine uses a cylinder of wax and a stylus that somehow transfers the vibration of the voice onto that wax. Then, when you play it back, the voice, or any sound, for that matter, is reproduced.
What will they think of next?
I've already thought of it.
Oh?
Yes. I proposed it to my professor in science class, and he said it was a good idea. though we had no idea how it could be done.
What is your idea?
I propose that you find some way to connect Mr. Alexander Graham's telephone with Mr. Thomas Edison's talking machine.
To what end?
Well, think about it, Father. Suppose someone, we'll make up a person and call her Mary, was equipped with a telephone in her own house. And someone else, let's say Mary's grandmother, is similarly equipped. The grandmother calls, but Mary isn't home. If a clever scientist could find a way to connect the talking machine to the telephone, the grandmother could leave a message.
Anna made a motion as if holding the telephone base with one hand and the earpiece with the other.
Hello, this is Mary. Thank you for calling me, but I am not home. However, you may leave a message for me on my talking machine. Mary, this is your grandmother. Please come to dinner at my house tomorrow night.
Anna made a motion of hanging up.
What do you think?
I think you have a very active imagination.
Active and fertile. In fact, I will make the prediction right now that someday some clever person will come up with just such a device, and whoever it is will no doubt think that he was the one who invented the answering machine, when a few of us will know that it was you.
Answering machine! Oh, what a delightful name for it!
After dinner that evening, Roosevelt invited Anna to take a walk with him, and she accepted. They walked from the judge's house down to the railroad station and back. The night was clear, and the sky was ablaze with stars.
I missed seeing the stars when I was in New York. At first I thought perhaps there were just fewer stars over New York. Later, of course, I realized it was just the brightness of the many gas lamps that made the sky seem dimmer.
Yes, the sky is beautiful out here. Everything seems more beautiful out here.
Roosevelt looked at Anna.
Everything.
Please, Mr. Roosevelt, you shall make me blush.
I'm sorry. I've no wish to embarrass you.
I know. I was teasing.
Oh.
They walked on in silence for a few moments longer.
Anna, I cannot tell you how much I have enjoyed being in your company.
And I've enjoyed your company as well.
Teddy.
I beg your pardon?
A moment ago you called me Mr. Roosevelt, and yet you insist that I call you Anna. I'm sure you've heard the expression, what is good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yes, I have heard that. Teddy.
I am glad you are my friend.
It isn't difficult being your friend. You're an interesting man, a fascinating conversationalist, and a generous soul.
I appreciate your appraisal of me. Especially since you are aware of my personal burden of grief.
Yes. I know that your wife and your mother both died recently. And on the same day, I know what tremendous grief you must be enduring.
I'm glad that you understand it. For I would not want to give you the wrong idea as to my intentions.
Oh, heavens, Teddy! Please do not think me a naive young girl who believes that the friendly attentions of a man friend must inevitably lead to matrimony.
It's not that I'd never want to marry again. Indeed, someday I think I will get married again, and if I do, I hope it is to someone just like you. But for now...
Anna put her hand on Roosevelt's arm.
I'm sure you will find someone just for you. And as to whether or not she is like me, well, time will just have to tell, won't it? In the meantime, let us be just as you proposed. Good friends who find pleasure in each other's company.
You are a good woman, Anna. A good woman indeed.
Now, perhaps you should take me back home before my father comes after us with a shotgun.
Huh? What?
I was teasing you, Teddy. Merely teasing.
It was nearly midnight, and Falcon McAllister extinguished the lantern on the table in the hotel room he had taken for the night. His room fronted the street, and as he happened to glance outside, he saw an orange glow in the darkness of the alley between two buildings across the street. Falcon watched for a moment, and as he watched, the glow brightened and dimmed. That told Falcon that he was looking at the tip of a cigarette. Someone was standing back in the shadows of the alley, smoking as he stared up at the hotel. Falcon knew what it was, but he didn't know who it was, or why the person was watching the hotel with such intensity. Down in the alley, Creed Howard put his cigarette out with the heel of his boot. Creed had spent the evening in the saloon, sitting in the back, quietly nursing his beer while he kept an eye on Falcon McAllister. Falcon had supper, then played a few hands of cards. Several men came over to talk to him, anxious to make friends with the man who could take on three assailants. Creed had nothing but disgust for him. They were making a hero out of the man who had been responsible for the death of one of his brothers and had killed the other. Creed spoke to no one for the entire time he was in the saloon. When Falcon left, Creed left as well. He had followed Falcon, staying about one block behind until Falcon went into the hotel. As it happened, Creed was staying at the same hotel, but rather than going in then, he had decided to wait across the street for a while. He had never met Falcon McAllister, so there was little chance he'd be recognized. On the other hand, he'd spent the entire evening in the saloon, and Falcon might have noticed him. It would be best for his plans if they didn't run across each other. Loosening the gun in his holster, Creed crossed the dark street. He stepped in through the front door of the hotel. The lobby was dark, except for a lantern that illuminated the stairway and another at the desk. Mr. Fillmore, the hotel clerk on duty at the front desk, was napping in his chair. Quietly, so as not to awaken him, Creed turned the registration book around so he could read the entries. He found the one he was looking for. Falcon McAllister, room 25. Creed reached around behind the desk and took the spare key from the hook under the number 25. As he went up the steps, he extinguished the stairway lamp, then each lantern in turn as he walked down the hallway toward room 25. Laying in his bed, Falcon watched the little line of light under his door dim more and more until it was dark. He got out of bed, pulled his pistol from the holster, and stepped into the far corner of his room. Falcon could see a shadow, but nothing more. He had no idea who this would-be assailant was. The room was suddenly lit by the muzzle blast of Creed Howard's pistol as he fired three shots into the bed. Feathers and dust flew from the bed as the bullets impacted. Falcon aimed just to the left of the flame pattern. Quickly, Falcon lit the table lantern and turned the flame up, filling the room with light. He stepped over to the body and turned it over. He didn't know who it was, but he remembered seeing him in the saloon, and he had thought it odd then how he had sat so quietly for so long. The man was still alive, though it was obvious he wouldn't be for long.
Who are you, and why'd you come for me?
The name's Howard. You killed both my brothers.
The law hung Thad Howard. I didn't. That's the only Howard I know of.
What's going on in here?
Looking toward the door, Falcon saw the hotel clerk and two of the guests drawn to his room by the sound of the shots.
I just come into my room and found this fella here. When I asked what he was doing in my room, he shot me.
Well, your room is 23, Mr. Howard. This is room 25.
Ain't that a hell of a note now? Got myself killed just for making a mistake on my room.
What? What the hell are you talking about, Howard? You know that's a lie.
Creed Howard knew nothing of the sword anymore. Creed Howard was dead. Falcon was sure he could almost see a smug smile on the dead man's face. Just then, the deputy sheriff, who had been making his night rounds, arrived on the scene.
Somebody want to tell me what just happened here?
It looks like Mr. Howard came into this fella's room by mistake, and this fella shot him.
Mister, that's a hell of a thing to do just because a man made a mistake. Couldn't you just told him it was the wrong room?
Now, he was lying. He came in here to kill me.
The deputy pulled his pistol.
Now, why would a dying man lie? You know what I think? I think maybe I should take you in until we get this all figured out.
Anna Heckmeyer was teasing Teddy Roosevelt about playing lawyer for one of the town's indigents.
My dear Anna, by no means is Mr. McAllister a man without means. In fact, he is far wealthier than anyone you knew in New York's social set, and that includes me.
McAllister?
Yes, Falcon McAllister.
Would he have a brother and a sister in the theater?
Yes, as a matter of fact, he does.
Andrew and Rosanna?
Yes, Andrew and Rosanna.
Why, I met him in New York. In fact, he very graciously shared his theater box with me and a couple of my friends. And now here he is with you as his lawyer. What a surprising turn of events.
Yes, especially when you consider that I'm not really a lawyer. But when he requested my services, even though I told him I am not a practicing lawyer, he secured his request by the offer of a rather substantial advance.
A substantial advance? What did he do, borrow money from his brother and sister in New York?
Hardly, since I've heard they often borrow money from Falcon.
And how is it that he has so much money?
It turns out that his father, Jamie Ian McAllister, was a man of considerable fame and fortune. He left Falcon several large caches of gold.
Falcon McAllister had spent an entire week in jail by this time. Roosevelt tried without success to get Judge Heckmeyer to set bail, but Anna's father refused, citing his belief that Falcon McAllister would flee at the first opportunity in order to avoid the trial.
And what makes you think he would flee?
Think about it, Teddy. He has no business or family ties to hold him here. He has, by your own account, an almost unlimited supply of money. What would keep him here?
Honor.
You are convinced he's a man of honor?
I am.
Judge Heckmeyer stroked his chin for a moment, as if considering Roosevelt's request.
I'm sorry, Teddy. I wish I could believe you. But the man has just killed too often, and I'm not convinced that anyone would find himself in so many situations where he must kill to survive. Your request for bail is denied.
I think you are wrong about Mr. McAllister, Judge, and I intend to prove it.
The courtroom was so full that the sheriff posted deputies at the door to prevent anyone else from coming in. Word had gotten out that Falcon McAllister was being tried. Because he was so well known, news reporters came from as far away as McAllister's Valley in San Francisco to cover the trial. One of the reporters even brought a sketch artist with him, and Anna was sitting behind the illustrator, watching with fascination as he developed the drawing. On the artist's sketch pad, Falcon McAllister sat at the defendant's table with his arms folded across his chest and an almost arrogant expression on his face as he glared at the judge and his father. The artist was exceptionally skilled in that he had captured Falcon's features so perfectly that someone seeing it would be able to recognize him immediately. There, the similarity ended. But while the artist depicted Falcon as arrogantly defiant, Falcon was in fact the picture of respect. He sat at the table with an attentive expression on his face, and every time he was spoken to, he responded politely. Both counselors were at their respective tables. The jury was in place, and the proceedings now awaited only the appearance of the judge.
All rise!
Everyone stood as Judge Heckmeyer came in and took his seat at the bench. He shuffled a few papers around, then looked up.
Bailiff, are all parties in place?
They are, Your Honor.
Let the record show that Mr. Ken Woodward is acting as prosecutor. Do you concur, Mr. Woodward?
A tall, gaunt man with long, flowing white hair and equally white chin whiskers stood up. He was wearing a light brown tweed suit with a dark brown silk vest.
I do so concur, Your Honor.
Are you ready to present your case?
I am, Your Honor.
Very good. Mr. Roosevelt, it is my understanding that you will be acting as counsel for the defendant.
I will be, with the court's permission.
How say you? Are you ready to present your case?
I am, Your Honor, but with the following caveat. Although I attended Columbia Law School, I did not take a law degree. I am not now, nor have I ever been, a practicing lawyer.
So noted. Mr. McAllister, you have chosen Mr. Roosevelt as your attorney. Are you aware that he lacks the qualifications to serve you?
I am aware, Your Honor, but he's the one I want.
You do understand, don't you, that he serves at the pleasure of the court? It is my prerogative to allow or prohibit his participation.
Yes, sir. But it is also my understanding that if I waive all rights to appeal on the basis of incompetent representation, I may have Mr. Roosevelt as my attorney.
That is correct. Do you now waive those rights?
Yes.
Very well. Your right to appeal is waived. Mr. Roosevelt is now your attorney of record. Mr. Woodward, you may proceed.
Woodward nodded, then walked over to face the jury.
Gentlemen of the jury, the time of the Wild West is gone now. Gone with the lost Atlantis. Gone tone and tint to the Isle of Ghosts and ancient dead memories. Men and women of culture and refinement are working hard to make gentle this wonderful land, to create a beautiful paradise where our children and our children's children can prosper and live in peace. But into this wonderful time and place of enterprise and civilization comes the person of Falcon McAllister.
Woodward pointed out Falcon to the jury.
Falcon McAllister. I'm sure that most, if not all, of you have heard of him, for he is a man whose reputation precedes him. Some, perhaps the writers of the dime novels, might find this reputation appealing. Others, with a misguided sense of hero worship, may even find him bigger than life, the stuff of legend. He is called a gunfighter, a gambler, and a bad man to crowd. He has been called a desperado, a highwayman, and a mercenary assassin. He is a deadly shot, a skilled fighter, and a man who, it is said, can track a buzzard's shadow. Who knows which of those stories are true, and which are fabricated from whole cloth? One thing that we do know, one thing that we have witnessed here in our old town, is that he is a killer. Within the space of the past few days, four men have faced Falcon McAllister, and four men have died. Mr. McAllister has made the claim, not only for these deaths of which we have personal knowledge, but for his many other killings, that in every case, the homicides were justifiable. Every man that he has killed, or so claims Mr. McAllister, was killed in self-defense. Now, think about that for a moment. How many of you have ever encountered someone who was so intent upon killing you that your only hope for survival was to kill them? None of you? Well, don't worry. You aren't alone. Fortunately for us all, it is an extremely rare situation when one man sets out to kill another. And yet, if we are to believe Falcon McAllister, he has killed at least 15 men who were trying to kill him. And the number may be far greater than that. We just don't know. But let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Let us say that for many, perhaps even for all of these previous killings, he is telling the truth. Even if that is true, we are not trying him for any of his previous killings. We are trying him for the aggravated manslaughter of one Creed Howard. Creed Howard's dying testimony, heard by no less than four witnesses, was that he had wandered into Falcon McAllister's room by mistake. Mr. Howard's room number at the hotel was 23, right next door to room 25. It is easy to see how such a mistake could be made, especially in the dark of night. Any one of this jury could have made the same mistake. Indeed, perhaps you have made such a mistake in the past. Or perhaps you have occupied a room where someone entered it by mistake.
Woodward turned from the jury to glare at Falcon.
For the average man, a man of civilized society, a man of decency, such a mistake would be met by embarrassment, confusion, and I will grant you, perhaps even a degree of irritation. But Falcon McAllister has killed so many times that he has become inured to the concept of killing. with no more thought than the average man would have in stepping on a cockroach. Falcon McAllister shot to death the stranger who made an innocent mistake.
Woodward resumed his seat. The artist in front of Anna had just completed his drawing of Woodward, casting the prosecutor in an almost heroic image. Roosevelt got up to address the jury.
Gentlemen of the jury, I agree with Mr. Woodward that the average man would not shoot to death a stranger who made the innocent mistake of entering the wrong room. Neither would Falcon McAllister. We intend to prove that Creed Howard was neither innocent nor did he make a mistake. He entered Falcon McAllister's room knowing full well that it was McAllister's room, and he did so with the intention of murdering Mr. McAllister.
Roosevelt sat down then, catching the judge, the jury, and the gallery by surprise, for they had thought that his opening statement would at least equal in length and more than likely even surpass Woodward's remarks. The sketch artist was the one who was the most surprised, however, for he'd barely begun his drawing.
Your Honor, I'd like to call my first witness.
Proceed.
The prosecution calls one Jason Fillmore to the stand.
Fillmore made his way to the stand and was sworn in. He was a small man with a red face, hooked nose, and thinning hair.
Mr. Fillmore, for the record, would you please state your full name and your occupation?
My name is Jason Leroy Fillmore, and I am the night clerk of the Morningstar Hotel.
And how long have you held that position?
For 6 years.
Very good. Now, if you would, please give us your account of the events of the night of the 12th.
Well, sir, I was at my front desk when I heard the gunshots.
How many shots did you hear?
I don't rightly know.
More than one?
Yes, sir. Three, maybe four of them. Like this. Bang, bang. And then right on top of the first two shots, I heard two more. Bang, bang.
And what did you do then?
Well, first thing I done is I got down behind my desk.
Order!
Then, what did you do?
Well, when I didn't hear no more shooting, I ran upstairs to see if I could find out what was going on.
And what did you see?
I seen the door open to room 25, and I seen a light shining out into the hall. So I went down there to look in, and that's when I saw the one fella kneeling over the other.
Who specifically did you see kneeling?
I saw him, Falcon McAllister.
Let the record show that the witness identified Falcon McAllister as the man kneeling. Is that when you saw the gun in McAllister's hand?
Objection, Your Honor. Leading the witness.
Sustained. Reword your question, Counselor.
Did you see anything in the defendant's hand?
Yes, sir.
What did you see?
I seen a gun.
Woodward walked over to the exhibit table and held up a Colt 44.
Is this the gun you saw?
Yes, sir. That's it.
Let the record reflect that the witness has identified Prosecution Exhibit 1 as the pistol he saw in Falcon McAllister's hand.
Woodward turned back to the witness.
Did you recognize the man on the floor?
Yes, sir. It was Creed Howard.
Was Creed Howard personally known to you?
I didn't know him personal-like, or nothing like that, but he was a guest of the hotel.
What was Mr. Howard's room?
Room 23.
Where was his room in relation to the room where you found him?
His room was right next door.
Was he still alive when you found him?
Yes, sir, he was.
Did Mr. Howard say anything?
Yes.
Fillmore looked accusingly toward Falcon McAllister.
He said he thought he had gone into his own room and discovered McAllister there.
Did you correct him? What exactly did you say?
I said, your room is 23, Mr. Howard. This is room 25.
And what did Mr. Howard reply?
He said, ain't that a hell of a note now? And he said, I got myself killed just for making a mistake on my room.
Thank you. No further questions.
Roosevelt stood up then, but he didn't approach the witness. Instead, he remained behind the defendant's table.
Mr. Fillmore, have you rented room 25 since the incident?
Yes. Nobody told me I couldn't do it.
Did you have to do anything to the room?
Do anything to it?
Yes, clean up the blood or anything.
Oh, yes, I did that.
Did you do anything else?
Oh, I just sewed up a couple of holes in the mattress is all.
What kind of holes?
Bullet holes. The sheriff took two bullets out of the mattress. They were 44 caliber bullets, same caliber as the gun McAllister was carrying.
Your Honor, please instruct Mr. Fillmore not to answer questions that I haven't asked. and I request that his remark be struck from the record.
Court recorder will strike the last comment. Jury, you will disregard. Mr. Fillmore, answer only the questions that are asked.
All right, Judge. Sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. No further questions at this time, but I reserve the right to recall this witness.
Witness may step down.
The prosecution calls to the stand Deputy Sheriff Jerry Kelly.
Jerry Kelly, the deputy on duty the night of the shooting, was sworn in.
Now, Deputy, tell us in your own words what happened on the night in question.
Well, I was making the rounds when I heard gunshots coming from the hotel. When I reached the scene, I saw Fillmore and two of the hotel residents standing in the hall looking into a lighted room.
And what room was this?
Room 25. I relieved McAllister of his weapon and placed him under arrest.
Were you present when the undertaker dug the bullet from Mr. Howard's body?
I was.
What caliber was the bullet?
It was a .44 caliber.
Woodward picked up the gun from the table.
Is this the gun you took from the defendant?
It is.
What caliber is this gun?
It is a .44 caliber.
Thank you. No further questions, Your Honor.
Roosevelt stood up.
Deputy Kelly, did you find another gun in the room?
I did.
Where did you find it?
It was on the floor by Howard.
In other words, it was Howard's gun.
Objection, Your Honor. Calls for conclusion.
Objection sustained.
Deputy Kelly, what was the caliber of the second pistol that you found?
It was a .44.
I see. And was Mr. Howard wearing a gun belt and holster?
He was.
Was there a pistol in his holster?
No.
Were there any cartridges in the bullet loops on the belt?
Yes.
I see. And what caliber were those bullets?
They were .44 caliber bullets.
All right now, just so that we have this straight. His holster was empty, but you found a .44 caliber pistol on the floor next to him. And the cartridges in the bullet loops were .44 caliber?
Yes.
You stated that you relieved Mr. McAllister of his pistol. How did you do that?
I beg your pardon?
How did you get the gun away from Falcon McAllister?
I asked him for it.
Suppose he had resisted.
I beg your pardon?
Given the ferocious reputation that prosecution has painted for him, if he had resisted, do you think you could have disarmed him?
Kelly squirmed in his seat and stroked his chin for a moment.
No, sir, I don't think I could have.
Thank you. No further questions.
Woodward called two other witnesses, both of whom were guests of the hotel. Their story was substantially the same. They heard gunshots, ran to the room, and heard Howard's dying testimony that he had wandered into the wrong room by mistake. After questioning his last witness, Woodward turned to the jury.
Gentlemen of the jury, as you have heard with your own ears, all four witnesses were present in time to hear Mr. Howard's last words. And those last words were a statement of surprise that he had been shot merely because he wandered into the wrong room by mistake.
Your Honor, is prosecution giving his summation now, before I've even had the opportunity to present my case?
That is a very good question, Mr. Roosevelt. Counselor, are you giving your summation?
No, Your Honor, I am not.
Then please call your next witness.
I have no further witnesses, Your Honor. The prosecution rests.
Very well. Then court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning, at which time we will hear from the attorney for the defense.
Roosevelt started putting papers away in his briefcase. Anna walked over to the defense table and smiled at the would-be attorney.
Teddy, you're doing wonderfully.
I thank you for your vote of confidence, but it's a little too early to make a valid judgment on my performance. All I have done today is parry the thrusts of the prosecution. Tomorrow will tell the tale.
I'm sure you will do very well.
The sheriff and his deputy came for Falcon.
Oh, gentlemen, before you take him away, please allow me to introduce him to my friend, Mr. McAllister. This is Anna Heckmeyer.
We've met.
Indeed we have. Allow me to thank you again, Mr. McAllister, for your graciousness in sharing your theater box.
It was my pleasure. Under the circumstances, I wish it had been your father rather than you. I'm afraid he doesn't like me very much.
I think you have him pegged correctly, sir. On the other hand, I know my father to be an honest man. I can promise you, you will get fair treatment in his court. Good luck to you, Mr. McAllister.
Well, thank you. I'm gonna need it.
When word reached Aaron Childers that Falcon McAllister was in jail and being tried for murder, he talked the others into going to Medora to see for themselves.
You want to tell me why we're coming into Medora when the fella who's been chasing us all this time is in this town?
Don't know why you're so worried, Dalton. Old McAllister sure as hell ain't in no condition to do us any harm now. I mean, being as he's in jail and being tried for his life.
Yeah! Besides which, when it comes time for him to string old McAllister up by his neck, I want to be there watching it happen.
The three men looked around warily as they rode into Medora. None of them had ever committed a crime in this town, but all three of them were wanted, and it could be that someone might recognize them. They rode right up 3rd Avenue until they reached the Golden Spur. The saloon was fairly busy, with nearly all the tables filled. In addition, there were several men standing at the bar. The bartender tossed a towel over his shoulder, then moved down the bar to greet Childers and the others.
Welcome, gents. What can I get for you?
Beer.
Yeah, beer.
I'll have, beer.
We just got some new barrels in from St. Louis. It's a really good brew.
Is it your cheapest?
No, sir, it isn't the cheapest. But wait until you taste it.
I ain't going to taste it if it ain't the cheapest. Give us the cheapest beer you got.
Yes, sir. Whatever you say.
Hey, is it true what they're saying about Falcon McAllister? Is he really being tried for murder?
Nah, not murder. He's being tried for manslaughter.
Manslaughter? What's that?
The illegal killing of a human being.
Well, hell, ain't that murder the same thing?
Nah, isn't the same thing at all.
Well, what's the difference?
For one thing, even if he's found guilty, he won't hang. The most that can happen to him is he'll wind up in territorial prison.
Yeah, but he ain't gonna be found guilty.
Who are you?
The name's Josh Andrew. What's your name?
Andrews extended a friendly hand. Instead of taking the cowboy's hand, Childers raised his glass to his lips.
Why do you say McAllister won't be convicted?
Because Mr. Roosevelt's defending him.
Hey, Aaron, that's me!
You know this here Roosevelt fella, do you?
Know him? Why, I'm proud to say that I work for him. I ride for the Elkhorn Ranch.
So he's your boss?
He is. And there's no finer boss in the land.
Is he good at lawyering?
Funny thing is, he ain't even a real lawyer. But he's better at it than just about any lawyer I've ever seen. But the plain fact is that Mr. Roosevelt is good at just about anything he does.
I'll say. He's sort of a dandified-looking fella. But that don't mean he can't fight.
That started a general discussion of the incident between Roosevelt and the one-time riders for Two Rivers Ranch, Zeb and Muley.
Of course, old Zeb and Muley's both dead now.
Dead? What happened to him?
McAllister killed him.
McAllister?
Overhearing the conversation, another cowboy joined in.
Funny, ain't it?
What's funny about it?
Well, here's McAllister being tried for killing a man that nobody in town even knew. But he ain't being tried for killing Zeb and Muley, and everyone in town knew them. Makes you think, don't it?
Yeah, that's because everyone did know those two that McAllister ain't being tried for killing them. Hell, when you get right down to it, there ain't nobody who didn't think that those two needed killing.
Look here. Are you saying you think McAllister's going to get off?
With Mr. Roosevelt defending? You damn right he's going to get off.
Yeah, but you know, don't you, that being good at lawyering ain't the only reason Roosevelt is going to get McAllister off.
What do you mean?
Hell, everybody knows that Roosevelt's been squiring Miss Anna Heckmeyer around. Not only that, I hear tell he's done got her won over to his side. And if she wants her paw to find McAllister not guilty, like as not that's the way it'll come out.
Are you saying the trial don't mean nothing? That even if the jury finds McAllister guilty, the judge would let him go?
If Miss Anna asks him to, he will.
I don't believe that. I've known Judge Heckmeyer for a long time. I've never known a more honest man.
I agree with you that the judge is an honest man, but there don't nobody set more store with the judge than his daughter. He'd do anything in the world for the girl.
That may be so, but don't none of that matter. I know Mr. Roosevelt. And I know he's not the kind of man that would use the judge's daughter like that.
I would.
What do you mean?
Well, think about it. All you got to do to win the bull is bait the calf. Like you said, the judge would do anything his daughter asked him to do. If I was Roosevelt, I'd play that card like it was the ace of spades.
Hey, court's about to start again.
What good does it do to tell us about it? Court's so crowded that nobody else can get in.
Yeah, but they some folks standing just outside the open windows listening in. They're letting everyone else know what's going on.
Hey, Aaron, we going over there and try to get in?
Childers shook his head and slapped a nickel down on the bar, signaling for a second beer.
If we hang around here, I reckon we'll be able to find out what's going on.
Mr. Roosevelt, you may call your first witness.
Defense calls Sheriff Walter Merrill of Belfield.
I object, Your Honor. What possible connection does the Sheriff of Belfield have to this case?
Your Honor, it goes to motive. Sheriff Merrill can dispute prosecution's claim that this whole incident was the result of an innocent mistake.
Objection overruled. The witness may testify.
Sheriff Merrill was sworn in, then he took the witness chair.
Sheriff, did you know Creed Howard?
I didn't know him personally, but I knew who he was.
How so?
A few weeks ago, we hung Thad Howard. Creed Howard was Thad Howard's brother.
And you know this because?
Because Creed and Bob Howard came to visit their brother Thad a few times before he was hung.
Who is Bob Howard?
It'd be better to ask who was Bob Howard. He was Creed Howard's brother.
Did he ever go by another name?
He sometimes went by the name of Bob Rafferty on account of he had a different mother from Thad and Creed. But he was a Howard, too.
Do you know what happened to Bob Howard?
Yes. He was killed a few weeks ago.
Who killed him?
Falcon McAllister.
For a moment, Anna wondered if perhaps Roosevelt wasn't making a mistake by calling that to everyone's attention.
Was Falcon McAllister responsible in any way for Thad Howard's death?
Yes, sir, you might say that in a way he was. You see, it was him what brung Thad Howard in.
So, on the night Creed Howard went into Mr. McAllister's room, both of his brothers were already dead, and Creed Howard blamed their deaths on Falcon McAllister?
Objection, Your Honor. Cause for speculation. The witness would have to be a mind reader to answer that question.
Sustained.
Let me reword that. Do you know who killed the man identified as Bob Rafferty, but whom we now know as Bob Howard?
Well, coroner's reports say he was killed by Falcon McAllister.
And though the hangman was ultimately responsible for the execution of Thad Howard, who brought him to justice?
Falcon McAllister.
All right. I'm not going to ask you who you think Creed Howard believed was responsible for the deaths of his two brothers, but I am going to ask you...
Objection, Your Honor! We've already been through this. The question calls for speculation.
Your Honor, I'm asking the sheriff who he believes is responsible. It is a question he can answer because it goes to his own thought process.
Heckmeyer paused for a moment, considering both remarks.
Objection overruled. You may question the sheriff about his personal belief, but you cannot ask him to speculate on whether or not Creed Howard blamed McAllister.
Very well, Your Honor. Sheriff, do you believe that Falcon McAllister was responsible for the death of the two Howard brothers?
He was responsible for all three of them.
Thank you. No further questions.
Roosevelt's next witnesses were experts on Falcon's accuracy with a firearm. There were three witnesses, all of whom had participated in shooting matches with Falcon. All were expert marksmen, but all conceded that Falcon was better than they were, better, in fact, than anyone they had ever seen use a gun.
Tell me this. In a 12 by 12 foot hotel room, is it likely that Mr. McAllister could discharge his weapon four times in the direction of a man and yet manage only one hit?
Objection, Your Honor. Cause for speculation.
Your Honor, this witness and the succeeding witnesses are all experts in the field of marksmanship. Indeed, when I began reading their qualifications, prosecution stipulated the same. As expert witnesses, they are entitled to speculate. That's what expert witnesses do.
Objection overruled. Witness may answer the question.
It isn't likely that in a room of the size you describe, Falcon McAllister could fire four shots at a man and miss three times. In fact, it isn't likely that he would miss one time.
Let us say that Mr. McAllister and Creed Howard were both in a 12 by 12 room. Let us say also that there are two pistols in the room, both of which are 44 caliber pistols. An examination of the cylinder in the pistol belonging to Falcon McAllister shows only one empty cartridge. An examination of Mr. Howard's pistol shows three empty cartridges. There are two bullet holes in the mattress. Who do you think is responsible for the bullet holes in the mattress?
Objection! Speculation beyond the scope of this witness's expertise.
Hell, counselor, you don't have to be an expert to figure that out. Any 6-year-old with half a brain could answer that.
Any more outbreaks like that, and I will clear this court. The witness is ordered to speak only when responding to a direct question. Another spontaneous response, such as you just gave, will result in a citing for contempt of court. Do you understand what I'm saying to you?
Yes, Your Honor. It won't happen again.
It had better not. Now, as regard to the objection is overruled. You may answer the question.
Your Honor, after all this, I've forgotten the question.
You may ask the question again, defense.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I've forgotten the question as well.
Good Lord. Clerk will read the question.
A thin, middle-aged man with a prominent Adam's apple and thick glasses read from his notes.
Let us say that Mr. McAllister and Creed Howard are both in a 12x12 room. Let us say that there are two pistols in the room, both of which are 44 caliber pistols. An examination of the cylinder in the pistol belonging to Falcon McAllister shows only one empty cartridge. An examination of Mr. Howard's pistol shows 3 empty cartridges. There are 2 bullet holes in the mattress. Who do you think is responsible for the bullet holes in the mattress?
Thank you. You may answer the question.
I would say that Creed Howard was responsible for the bullet holes in the mattress.
Thank you. No further questions.
Woodward walked over from the prosecutor's table and took off his glasses and polished them for a moment while he formed his question.
You have testified that Falcon McAllister was an excellent shot.
Best I ever seen.
As an expert witness, would you say that some men can shoot very well at a still target, and yet those same men, as good as they might be, would have a more difficult time shooting at a man?
Oh, yes, sir. Happens all the time.
So, such a man might hit a target 4 times out of 4. But in a life-and-death situation, firing against an armed adversary, his accuracy might be impaired.
His accuracy might be what?
He is less likely to hit an armed man 4 times out of 4 than he would be to hit a stationary target.
Yes, sir. That's true.
Thank you. No further questions.
But if you're a-thinking that McAllister missed 3 shots out of 4, you're dead wrong.
Thank you, sir. I have no further questions for this witness.
The succeeding witnesses substantiated the testimony of the first, insisting that Falcon would not shoot 4 times but manage only 1 hit.
Your Honor, defense recalls Mr. Elton Bowman.
Elton Bowman had been one of the guests in the hotel who had come to the room in response to hearing the shots.
Mr. Roosevelt, from all I heard about you, you're a good man. But I'm telling you right now, I ain't going to change my testimony none. I seen what I seen, and that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman. In fact, I don't want you to change your testimony. But I'm less interested in what you saw than I am in what you heard.
I beg your pardon?
The gunshots. I want you to tell the court about the gunshots you heard.
I heard 4 of them.
Roosevelt returned to the table and picked up a piece of paper.
Yes, I wrote down your testimony, and of course, so did the court clerk. But I want to read this back to you, and I would like for you to verify if it is correct.
All right.
I am particularly interested in the rhythm of the gunshots.
I don't know what you mean by that.
By rhythm, I mean the pattern of the shooting, the way the sound happened. You said you heard the gunshots like this, I believe. Bang, bang, bang. A short pause, then bang. Is that correct?
Bang, bang, bang. Bang. Yes, sir, that's exactly the way I heard it.
Thank you. No further questions.
2 other witnesses testified that the sound pattern was exactly as Bowman had said. 3 shots, followed by 1. Only Fillmore, the hotel clerk, stuck to his original story that it was 2 shots, followed by 2 more.
Very well, Mr. Fillmore. I know that these things can be confusing. So, let's go on to something else, shall we?
All right.
How did Creed Howard get into Falcon McAllister's room?
He used the key.
Does the key to room 23 also fit room 25?
No, of course not. If that was the case, there wouldn't be no need to lock the doors.
So, somehow, perhaps by mistake, Creed Howard had the key to Mr. McAllister's room. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
In fact, There was a key found in the door, was there not?
Yes.
How do you suppose that got there?
I don't know, unless Mr. McAllister left it in the door when he first arrived. That happens from time to time.
When a guest signs in, how many keys do you give him?
Why, I give him one key, of course.
Do you have more than one key to a room?
Yes.
If you give one key to the guest, what happens to the second key?
There are hooks just behind the desk. Each hook has a number that corresponds to the room number, and the extra key is hanging on them hooks.
Roosevelt returned to the defense table and picked up a sheet of paper.
This is the inventory of things that Falcon McAllister had on his person when he was arrested. One room key, fitting the lock of the door to room 25.
Yes, the one in the door. He must have left it there.
No, Mr. Fillmore. This inventory covers only those things that McAllister had on his person. It wasn't until the next day that Sheriff Dennis returned the key to you. The key in the door was a second key, was it not?
It... Yes. I suppose it was.
So much for the keys. Let's move on to something else. All the witnesses testified that the lamps in the hall were dark. Why didn't you light the lanterns that night?
What are you talking about? I did light them. I light them every night. Why, that's just as regular as winding the clock.
I can understand one lantern burning out. But all of them? Is that very likely?
Well, no, it isn't, but I did light them.
Oh, I believe you, Mr. Fillmore.
I should hope that you believe me.
So if you lit them, what happened? Why were they all out?
Well, I don't know.
Is it possible that someone extinguished them?
Objection! Calls for speculation!
No, I think I'll let this one go. Mr. Fillmore is the night clerk at the hotel. Who would be better qualified to hazard a guess as to whether or not the lanterns had been extinguished? You may answer, Mr. Fillmore.
Yes. It isn't only possible that someone extinguished them. Now that I think on it, that probably is what happened.
Why would someone extinguish them, do you suppose?
I don't have the least idea why anyone would do that.
Suppose all the lanterns were extinguished. Would it be possible for someone like Creed Howard, for example, to sneak into Mr. McAllister's room, shoot him, then use the cover of the dark hallway to slip into another room without being seen?
Yes. It was Creed Howard put out the lights?
Objection! That's a conclusion, not in evidence.
Sustained. Mr. Roosevelt, you have been cautioned about this before. Jury will disregard.
That's not enough. How's the jury going to disregard what they just heard? That's like trying to unring a bell.
That's enough, Mr. Woodward. I have sustained your objection. Any further discourse on your part, and you will be flirting with a contempt of court citation. Continue, Mr. Roosevelt.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Fillmore, if someone wanted to see who was in the hotel, indeed, determine even the room, could they do it?
Yes.
How?
By looking at the registration book.
Can they see it from the customer side of the desk?
No. Not unless it was turned around. Damn! It was turned around. I didn't think anything of it. But the book was turned around. Turned toward the customer side.
Thank you. No further questions, Your Honor.